from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. And the first thing to say is this. We have a situation here. We envisioned a debate between high-tech guru and intelligent design advocate George Gilder and the titans of evolutionary biology. But every biologist we asked declined to enter that debate for fear of giving intelligent design too much standing. We finally thought we had Richard Dawkins, perhaps the world's top Darwinist, signed up, but late in the game, he too declined a head-to-head with Gilder. So, this morning we'll have them back-to-back. First, George Gilder, then Richard Dawkins. Here is why this debate itself is widely seen as a problem. Among scientists, Darwin's theory of evolution is the accepted understanding, grounded now in many years of research and deep evidence, of how the multitude of living things came to be. Debating evolution, they say, moves immediately out of science and into politics and religious belief. And yet, many millions of Americans have not come to terms with evolution. The latest challenge comes from intelligent design advocates who argue that living organisms are simply too complicated to have emerged by chance. Scientists say hogwash. President Bush says both sides ought to be properly taught. That's a quote. This hour, On Point, George Gilder on intelligent design and Richard Dawkins on evolution, back to back. You can join the conversation. Has your mind been changed one way or the other by the latest tempest over evolution? Why doesn't this debate die? And where are you in the evolution intelligent design debate? Should there even be a debate? Join the conversation this morning, today, at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in this On Point studio is George Gilder. We will hear at about half past the hour from Richard Dawkins. George Gilder is co-founder of the Seattle-based Discovery Institute, a think tank that advocates for intelligent design. And in his own right, he's been a hugely influential American iconoclast. He fought feminism at its height, championed supply-side economics with Ronald Reagan, and drove the telecom train before it crashed. His books include Wealth and Poverty, Men and Marriage, and his latest, The Silicon Eye. George Gilder, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
So here we are, and we have very fresh news. I wonder what you make of it. The Kansas Board of Education voted 6-4 yesterday to include greater criticism of evolution in its school science standards. Are you for that or against it, George Gilder?
That'll be good for the study of biology. I mean, biology is a fascinating subject, and part of its fascination comes from the huge number of imponderables that remain in it. At the heart of biology, what distinguishes living creatures from everything else is the processing of information. And the central dogma of biology, as expounded by Francis Crick, who defined the DNA molecule.
Of Watson and Crick fame.
Watson and Crick. And the central dogma is that DNA information comes first and the protein embodiment comes second. In other words, the information cannot flow in the other direction. And later on, a member of the Manhattan Project and student of Oppenheimer named Hubert Yaki, working with George Gamow from the beginning, who George Gamow, one of the titans of physics, who originally proposed this information basis for life, showed that this was a mathematical principle, that it was impossible for 20 amino acids to pass information backward to 64 DNA codons. There's just too much information in the codons to be specified by 20 amino acids.
So I want to be sure that we all follow this. This is your take. You root intelligent design not by hook or by crook. We'll talk about this, but in divinity, in a God as a creator. As far as I understand, we'll speak to that. But you say that it links back to information theory.
It's fundamental.
And are you saying that that information comes before the proteins?
Yes,
DNA? And are you saying that evolutionary biology has it the other way around?
Yes. Evolutionary biology assumes that physics and chemistry explain the huge prodigality of information manifest in living creatures.
And the fact is that
this is a return to the reactionary physics of Lamarck and Lysenko, who believed that proteins come first and that acquired characteristics could be inherited. This is a reactionary movement that tries.
Darwin was a reactionary, not a progressive, not a breakthrough thinker.
He was a great breakthrough thinker in his time, and he never imagined that he'd addressed or solved the problem of origins. There was a brief reference to a warm little pond that he
origin retracted. Origin of species?
Origin of species, but not origin of all life. He assumed the cell, and the cell is he assumed that the cell essentially, with some refinements, was a simple lump of protoplasm. I believe that just as classical physics collapsed after the discovery of the atom, that the atom was not a massy blank particle as previously believed, but was an arena of information that now we discover spreads out across the universe through the phenomenon of entanglement. Quantum theory overthrew Newtonian physics. Mm-hmm. So the theory of information is going to overthrow biology as we discover that the cell is not a lump of protoplasm, but a vastly complex information processor, an information processor more powerful than all the supercomputers in the world put together.
We're going to have to walk through that even one more time. But let me put this to you. What I hear you saying is that the evolution of ideas will leave evolution as we've understood it behind. You know that when you say that, scientists who have spent their lives studying this and building on the shoulders of many scientists who came before absolutely tear their hair out. I mean, it just drives them crazy when you talk that way. They call you a con artist, a crank, call you dishonest, and they just don't begin to buy it. They say, this is the core. This is not some will-o'-the-wisp hypothesis. This is deeply established theory. It goes straight to how we understand everything on Earth. And you're saying, no, we'll come to the politics around that, but walk us through once more. You cited the sources here, but take us through in elementary tinker toy kind of terms what you mean. Why information rather than protein? And what's the new angle that you say you're bringing here?
Okay. Summa book. My book here, The Silicon Eye, which explains the failure of biology to define the eye sufficiently clearly so anybody could build one through an electronic process.
Okay, well,
that's
assume
what
a book.
My book is
okay,
about.
Okay, give
the
us the metaphor.
Eye.
Work that out for us.
But finding life in traces of protein is like trying to find the contents of this book by a chemical and physical analysis of the paper and ink on which it's produced. Defining life through protein is like trying to predict the outcome of a Super Bowl by studying the rules of football.
Why do evolutionary biologists are leaving aside the information? I mean, evolutionary biologists would say, and Richard Dawkins will speak to himself in a moment, they would say, our further exploration of the genome, the carrier of all this information, only further confirms the depth of the theory of evolution, that this is building one upon another generation. Natural selection's underway here. They don't exclude the genome. They don't exclude information from the theory.
They believe that the information is a product of the chemistry and physics. Right now, based on this Lamarckian Lysenko heresy, which says that proteins come first and information comes second, we are sending spaceships off into to find traces of protein on Mars or Venus or whatever in order to determine whether life could have been present on these.
What are you suggesting, that it could exist as disembodied information?
Yeah, information is the source of life, not protein.
Is that information a euphemism for God?
No, it's not a euphemism for God. It's a, however, information does imply intelligence.
Is that intelligent designer that you allude to God?
It could be God. It could. You can.
How do you picture this?
God points to things we don't know. What religion is a metaphor, and what a metaphor does is point beyond what we know to things we can't say directly.
But can religion also blind us to things that we do know?
So God is not a scientific proposition. And I'm a scientist. I've devoted my life to writing scientific books, 13 of them so far. My last one is about the biology of the eye and how you can make a camera from just a rudimentary understanding of the eye. Now,
you're playing God. We've got to take a break. We'll talk about Richard Dawkins, and we'll talk with Richard Dawkins, the world's top Darwinist, perhaps, evolutionary biologist, at 1:30 this hour. We've got another 10 minutes or so with George Gilder on the intelligent design side. Then comes evolution. They say they shouldn't even debate this, that it is beneath and beyond the realm of science. What do you think? Has your mind been changed in one way or another by the new tempest over evolution and intelligent design? What about President Bush saying we should teach them both? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about evolution, Charles Darwin, and the new challenge in American public life from advocates of intelligent design. This was the debate that evolutionary biologists do not want to have. They refused to a man and woman to come on with George Gilder, who joins me in this half the hour. But Richard Dawkins, perhaps the world's top Darwinist, has agreed to join us not head-to-head, but back-to-back. We'll hear from him in just a few minutes from the U.K. You can join this conversation. Why can't America ever seem to come fully to terms with evolution? And where are you in the evolution intelligent design debate? Should there even be a debate? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. George Gilder's latest book is The Silicon Eye. We've got him for another 10 minutes or so. I want to make the best use of that. Tony's calling from Potsdam, New York. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I don't know a whole lot about your guest. I would guess that listening to him, he has a rather deep and abiding faith, which is fine. But that does not really address issues in science. And to say that, well, gosh, you know, we can't figure out how the eye works based on biological models or physical models in the case of silicon, therefore there must have been, quote, divine intervention, close quote. Well, you know, if that works for you, that's fine. But again, I would say that's not science.
Tony, yesterday the Kansas Board of Education voted 6-4 to allow more criticism of evolution into the schools. There's still one level of review left on that. But what do you think of that movement?
Well, I like what H.L. Mencken said about 80 years ago when he referred to folks like that as Bible-beating bunko artists, bigots, and ignoramuses.
You know who Mencken liked? I shouldn't.
George Gilder.
Mencken really approved of Hitler. He had bad moments of enthusiasm for Hitler. I really don't think quoting Mencken is relevant, nor do I think referring to my faith is relevant to my science. The Silicon Eye is all about scientists at Caltech. This is not a bunch of bunkum artists from Kansas or whatever.
But let's speak to that. And Tony, thank you for raising it. George Gilder, let us understand that. Yeah. You were raised as a person of deep religious conviction. How does that abut or influence your views on the science here, or does it?
Well, my views on science are separate but complementary to my views on religion.
Complementary in what sense?
I think that the idea of intelligence in the universe is real. I don't know what it is. I can't scientifically identify it. But the idea that the only intelligence in the world is ours is improbable to me. And I also believe that Darwinists have yet to explain biological phenomena sufficiently well so that you can even imagine a fully Darwinist scheme for producing them, like an eye, as my book explores. And information has been my subject for
it has throughout for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And writing about information, and information comes first. And religion and information converge in a sense when I say that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh, and that exactly recapitulates the central dogma of biology as expounded by Francis Crick.
There goes the thread to the Bible. You're comfortable with that. You see a proper metaphor there. Science turns around and says, we'll talk with Richard Dawkins about exactly what science is. Jerry is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Jerry, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
We're well, thanks.
I'm glad to hear it. I really find this horrendous. I happen to deal with a lot of people from other countries, and I ask them about these things. I ask them about the sort of reactionary things that are going on in this country that this is one of. And they're pretty much amazed. They're just astounded. They look at me as though, you know, what is going on in this country? But I'd like to say a couple of things. I read a book a while back by a woman doctor. I can't remember her name. She was an MD. And she said that, you know, she's...
Go straight to it, Jerry. Our time is short. Go straight to it.
Her position was that God put the rock fossils to trick man. You know, to have a big joke on man.
Right. So the evidence is God's joke. Jerry, we're going to take it there. George Gilder, what about the evidence that evolutionary biologists point to overwhelmingly and say, look at the record. Look at the record in the earth. Look at the record in our genes.
Well, I think there's a lot of evolution has happened. I think Darwin's concept was very plausible and interesting, and it probably bears a lot of truth. I just think that to banish intelligence from the universe is a ridiculous proposition. That also to celebrate a view of human beings as modified apes or as trousered apes, as Duncan Williams has memorably described it, is destructive. We already know we're animals. What's significant is human intelligence, which is the most powerful force in the universe.
Are you saying that that's interesting in itself? Human intelligence, the most powerful force in the universe?
I believe that over the next century, as Ray Kurzweil's book shows, it's a great book called The Singularity is Near.
He's going to live forever.
That human beings are going to be able to project their intelligence into the universe.
Our evolution.
I believe that as they do this, they will find a corresponding intelligence in the universe. And the idea that there is no intelligence in the universe is defied by the informative complexity of the life forms on Earth and the incredible and exquisite precision of the constants of nature as embodied in the cosmos.
George Gilder, you know that you know because you've been paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for speaking engagements and for your newsletters over the years that you're a charismatic guy and you get wound up, you get enthused by ideas. And that enthusiasm is patently infectious. But you know you get accused of being a sensationalist. The dot-com, telecom bubble burst. A lot of people lost a lot of money there. Is this George Gilder's latest enthusiasm that's going to leave? You say it's the future. Okay. But the other view might be this is George Gilder's latest hobby horse, and you're throwing America off the beam of science that has been the mainstay of this country's success in the world, the torch-bearing part of this country's history.
And information theory is a great triumph of this scientific effort in America. It's behind the whole telecommunications capabilities in which we led the world until the crash, which was caused by overregulation in 50 different states in the United States.
Not Gilder's fault, you say?
It was not my fault, but it continues at the, you know, all the various indices of advance of American technology continued through the crash and Korea and move to Asia.
Does evolution have to be defeated as an idea for your view of the universe to win? Do you have to discredit it?
No, materialism has to be defeated.
Everybody
believes in evolution in some form. Mm. The question is how and whether there was any intelligence involved in this amazing process. And I believe that there is intelligence in the universe, and I can't tell you just what form it takes. But I believe that there is intelligence in the universe, and that the information embodied in living forms reflects this intelligent force in the universe. And there's a great book by Hubert Yockey called Information Theory, Evolution, and the Origin of Life, which celebrates Darwin, but also insists that the question of origins itself is undecidable. It's like
And with that, we've got to close it. That's exactly where the American public conversation is being taken. More than half Americans now saying they, according to a CBS poll, saying they believe in creationism. Maybe two-thirds want it taught in school. George Gilder, not a head-to-head, but a back-to-back, and we're grateful to you for your time and your thoughts. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
George Gilder, co-founder of the Discovery Institute, a public policy think tank advocating intelligent design. He's author of the latest book he's put out is The Silicon Eye. Now, to keep this debate going, though not head-to-head, we turn to Oxford, England. I'm joined there now by evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. He holds the Charles Simony Chair in Public Understanding of Science at the University of Oxford and is the author of The Ancestor's Tale, The Selfish Gene, The Blind Watchmaker, and Unweaving the Rainbow. He has been called the world's top Darwinist. We're happy to welcome him here this hour. Richard Dawkins, thank you for joining us.
Hello.
So here we are. You've listened in on this last half hour. George Gilder, a very prominent American thinker, an iconoclast and contrarian very often to be sure, but nevertheless, a big voice connected to other voices. I don't know if the volume of this intelligent design debate has fully reached you across the pond there in the UK, but your first response to the last half hour or so of what you've heard.
Well, it's kind of half reached us. I must say I was interested to hear George Gilder as apparently the leading spokesman for intelligent design, and I hope that Americans will also be interested to hear the leading spokesman of intelligent design. Where can I begin? He seemed to begin by talking about Francis Crick's central dogma and the centrality of DNA information as against protein,
yes,
which he rightly said is an important principle of biology. By some bizarre misunderstanding of biology, he seemed to think that Darwinism goes against that. He used the phrase Lysenkoist Lamarckian error, which of course it's an error. It's the error that Darwin himself pointed out. He then made a great deal about information. Information comes first. Well, I would accept that in a sense information comes first. The central message of my first book, The Selfish Gene, is that DNA information, in a sense, comes first. He then said information implies intelligence. Well, now we come really down to the wire. Mm. Information does not imply intelligence. That was the genius of Darwin. Superficially, it looks as though information implies intelligence. Mm-hmm. But then if you give it a second thought, you realize that that actually cannot be so, because if you're going to postulate a supernatural intelligence as the origin of the complexity of life. And by the way, yes, information just is another word for complexity. It's a kind of snow job to pretend that it's anything else. Complexity is, of course, organized complexity, specified complexity,
yes,
is an important phenomenon which all of biology has to solve. That's what we're about. That's what biology needs to do. It was the genius of Darwin to show that organized complexity can come about from primeval simplicity. It precisely does not require an original intelligence in order, or an original complexity in order to get it going. And it's just as well that it doesn't, because if it did, then we'd be left with an infinite regress saying, where does the original intelligence come from?
Let me ask you about that, if I may, Richard Dawkins, just on that point, because this is a central argument that George Gilder didn't ride that hard, but many intelligent design advocates do. They say life is simply too complex to be explained through natural selection, the central premise of evolution. Please respond to that.
Indeed, I will. If life is too complex to have been produced by natural selection, then it's sure as hell too complex to be produced by another complex agent, namely a divine intelligence. That is an absolutely inescapable piece of logic. If you're going to say that life is too complex to be explained by natural selection, then you cannot invoke an even more complicated agent.
You're saying that if billions of years of the tumult of life interacting and selecting, and all of the shifts and changes that went on in there, are you saying you cannot imagine an intelligence greater than the cumulative, in effect?
No, of course I'm not saying that. Mm. I'm saying that the task of biology is to explain where all that complexity comes from. Mm-hmm. Now, to invoke a complexity, an intelligence, a complex agent, as the designing being, is to explain precisely nothing, because you're left asking, where did the designer come from? Now, the beauty of Darwinism is that it precisely does not do that. Mm. The beauty of Darwinism is that it starts from primeval simplicity, and it gradually works up by gradual degrees, by importing information, if you want to use that term, by natural selection. And it really works. It's arguably the most elegant, the most beautiful idea that's ever occurred to a human mind, because it is so deeply, deeply simple. And at the same time, what it explains is so immensely complicated and elegant.
Richard Dawkins, can you speak to this? Because it's raised often in the American debate. Critics of evolution say the evidence is incomplete. There are gaps in the evidence. It cannot be fully asserted and understood. Can you speak to that?
If it were true that the evidence was incomplete, by what extraordinary twisted logic would you say, because theory A can't explain it in some respect, therefore theory B must be right, when theory B doesn't even begin to be able to explain it? Theory A, Darwinism, in my opinion, does explain it. But just suppose that it didn't. Just suppose there was some difficulty that we hadn't solved, that was difficult to solve. So that would mean that science would need to go back to work to try to find another theory, some new wrinkle on the theory, something that would explain this gap. The one thing we would not do is to say, oh, well, we can't explain it by our science, therefore God must have done it. I mean, how pathetic is that?
Well, from where you sit in the UK, looking across the Atlantic, what do you make of this quite high-volume American resurgence of debate about evolution?
Well, it's not true that we don't have wingnuts in this country who believe in these things. We do. The difference is that in this country they don't get into political power.
But we're talking not only people in political power, but millions and millions, a majority by some polls, saying creationism is their ultimate understanding of the origin of life.
Well, I can only say the remedy for that is education. Actually, Darwinism is an extremely simple idea. It's very, very sad that so few people understand it. When I have done radio phone-ins in America, I have been, in a way, quite encouraged, because I'd expected to get hostile questioning from creationists. Mm-hmm. What I got instead was questions from people who were clearly, honestly ignorant. They just didn't know about it, hadn't been taught it. And it didn't take very long to explain things to them sufficiently that they would say, well, that's really interesting. I never knew that. I never thought of that. So I think that perhaps education is part of the problem.
And now we may be headed the other way with with any number of states now, almost a couple dozen, looking at incorporating intelligent design, even potentially creationism, into a range of views taught on the origin of life. Richard Dawkins in Oxford, England, please stand by. We're going to continue this back-to-back, Gilder and Dawkins, in just a moment. We're talking about evolution, Charles Darwin, and the new challenge in American public life from advocates of intelligent design. You can join us. Why can't America ever seem to come fully to terms with evolution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services, in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are in the midst of not a head-to-head, but a back-to-back debate this morning on evolution and the challenge from advocates of intelligent design lately in the United States. George Gilder joined us earlier talking up intelligent design. Right now, we are joined from Oxford, England, by Richard Dawkins, perhaps the world's foremost Darwinist, who says, come on, get a grip from his perch high in the realms of science. You can join us as well. Where are you in the evolution intelligent design debate? Should there even be a debate? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Imran is calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Imran, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to maybe get Professor Dawkins' view on the fact that it seems to me, at least an increasing divide between the view of cosmologists like Paul Davies, John Pokinthorne, Frank Tipler, and evolutionists, where the cosmologists kind of argue that, you know, when you look at the fact that, you know, the universe is created, maybe there's multiverses and so on, that the chance that this could all arise is so remote that they're starting to think that, well, maybe there is a prime cause, and you can call it God or whatever you want. And my add-on to that is that if people are so willing to put their faith into the remoteness of such a statistically small event as the Big Bang and creation, why are people so reluctant to try to put faith into something that might be equally as remote, such as the existence of God?
Let's hold it right there, man. That's a mouthful. Richard Dawkins.
Right. I do think it's true that cosmologists are slightly more likely to be theists than biologists. In earlier times, biology was the thing that provided the most powerful apparent evidence for the existence of a creator. Darwin solved all that. I think, in a way, cosmology is waiting for its Darwin. However, I would add this, that biology is supremely complicated. Complexity is the really difficult thing that you might think you'd need a designer for. Darwin solved that. The universe actually is not very complicated. The universe does have, on the face of it, a very high level of improbability, in the sense that some cosmologists think that the fundamental constants of physics might be very, very finely tuned. If any of them were slightly different, the universe couldn't exist or life couldn't exist, that kind of thing. Some people are tempted to invoke, because of that, a creator to fine-tune the constants of the universe. Once again, that cannot be right, because you're left with the problem of explaining where the fine-tuner comes from. So wherever else the tuning comes from, it cannot come from an intelligent creator. The multiverse theory that you mentioned is interesting. The idea there is that if it's true that the fundamental constants are very improbably tuned, then one way to explain it is to say that there are billions of separate universes all coexisting. And of course, by definition, we have to be in one of that minority of universes which is capable of giving rise to life. So that's not Darwinism. It bears a very superficial resemblance to Darwinism. The big difference is that it only had to happen once, whereas Darwinism happened again and again throughout the history of life. That is a definite process whose details and whose complexity we fully understand. Physics has got a long way to go.
Richard Dawkins, if I may then, picking up on Imran's question about the divine, you are famously and outspokenly atheist and a great critic of religion, to a point that in the American conversation it might be hard for you to fit into the great religiosity of this country easily. But what do you say to Imran on the front of divinity? And you've said the world would be better off without religion. Do you mean by that including in its understanding of its science, the origins of life itself?
Yes, I do think we'd be a lot better off without religion. However, it's important to point out that the great majority of reputable religious people and theologians do believe in evolution. So there manifestly is not, as a matter of fact, a contradiction if you look at people's opinions, because from the Pope, the late Pope at least, and the Archbishop of Canterbury and all the bishops down, you'll find that churchmen in one way or another believe in evolution, as indeed do most of the intelligent design people, though that's often forgotten.
But certainly not all American churchmen, certainly not in the on the evangelical front, where there's a literal interpretation of the Bible, people even saying it's a matter of a few thousand years and 7 days and so on.
You are right. I mean, you can say that again. There are many of them who say that the world is literally, the entire universe is less than 10,000 years old. Do you realize what that means? The entire universe began after the Middle Stone Age. That's the kind of Stone Age mentality we're talking about among these clergymen that you've just referred to.
Do you see intelligent design as a new view on the origin and development of life, or as the old creationist argument in fancy new clothes?
No, of course it's not new. It is simply creationism having put on new clothes as a political trick. And by the way, talking of political tricks, I read recently that the Discovery Institute has hired a high-powered and expensive public relations firm called CRC. You won't catch scientists hiring public relations firms in order to propagandize their science.
Let's take one more call. Malaja is calling from Hudson, New Hampshire. Hi, Malaja, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Malaja. The question I wanted to pose to your guest is, we have, in this day and age, like a pen, a uniform, a piece of paper are the simplest things that we get to use. And those things were created by someone. So how can he be sitting there telling us that we human beings that are very complicated, how can you tell me that nobody created us, we just came into being from evolution?
Malaja, let's pick it up right there. It's huge. Something from nothing. It's the old and basic question, Richard Dawkins.
Well, I'm afraid I cannot say much more than just go away and read a book. I mean, there's a huge literature on how evolution works. Very, very simply, once you get self-replicating information, the origin of life, which comes about by a lucky chemical accident. Darwinian natural selection gets going, evolution gets going. It's a very, very slow and gradual process. It starts from simple beginnings. It progresses over generations by a non-random, I stress that, a non-random process of survival of the fittest. Those genetic fragments of information that work, which means are good at building bodies, which are good at surviving and reproducing, those are the ones that do survive and reproduce. Those are the ones whose descendants are around today. They get very good at it. They become exceedingly complicated. They get very interdependent. That's what life is all about. Books and books and books, shelf miles of books have been written about this. Obviously, I can't tell you in a soundbite. Do go away and read a book. They're fascinating. You'll love them.
Richard Dawkins, what about this? At the very point of origin there, of life, which you describe as a lucky chemical accident, and you can hear many religious Americans really struggle with that. What's your, as an atheist and even as an opponent of religion, but a great advocate of scientists and science, an illuminator of life, attitudinally, let's leave the education, the reading aside for a moment, attitudinally, what's your advice to a very religious person who wants to reach out and embrace science? What's the attitude that allows those to coexist, knowing that you're not one of those religious people?
Well, if I were one of those religious people, what I'd probably say is that evolution is God's method of creating life. I personally have always found that a very unconvincing line of argument, but it's a very widespread one. I would suggest reading maybe Kenneth Miller's book, Finding Darwin's God. I haven't recommended one of my own books, but Kenneth Miller is a very devout Christian. His book, Finding Darwin's God, contains the finest and most devastating destruction of so-called intelligent design theory that I've read. I would recommend that.
And Richard Dawkins, finally, I've just cut you for another minute. We're trying to keep it straight up here. We've got another voice you want to bring in. But what do you think of debating this? I mean, you didn't want to go head-to-head with George Gilder. We understand that. Nevertheless, you see the opinion polls in America and how widespread these ideas are. How is science to triumph here?
Well, it is a very difficult political decision, and it's unfortunate that scientists have to play politics. I do not think that people who are not scientists and who are advocating a fundamentally anti-scientific point of view should be debating scientists as though they were on some kind of equal footing, as though there really is a scientific debate to be had. You might as well have a reproductive biologist debating the stork theory of where babies come from.
Well, that's pretty simple and pretty straightforward, and with that attitude, we're doubly grateful to you for being back-to-back in this conversation this morning. We're grateful for your time. Thanks for joining us again on Point, and we hope to speak with you in the future. Richard Dawkins, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist, professor of the public understanding of science at the University of Oxford. His most recent book is The Ancestor's Tale, A Pilgrimage to the Dawn of Evolution. All right, now that was some interesting process getting to that conversation, not head-to-head, but back-to-back. I hope illuminating. At the same time, this is clearly a huge and unresolved issue within the American public. Many states considering bringing the teaching of intelligent design or creationism or both into the schools. I want to get some perspective on how this conversation, this debate, if you will, is unfolding. We are joined this morning from Bogota, Colombia, by Michael Roos. He's director of the History and Philosophy of Science program at Florida State University, author of The Evolution-Creation Struggle and Can a Darwinian Be a Christian? Michael Roos, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
So here we are. The scientists would not debate the intelligent designers, but the intelligent designers are driving a lot of public opinion in this country. Is this an old pattern when great new theories, even though it's more than a century old now, when they come onto the public scene, do they have waves and waves of resistance like this?
Well, I mean, of course, that's what intelligent design people want to say. I mean, listening into the conversation, I was impressed at all what good behavior everybody was on today. Maybe it's the Boston air.
We try.
You know, people don't like to quarrel there. But, I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that this is one of the ongoing debates between science and religion. I mean, intelligent design theory is tarted up to look like science, but it isn't really. It's trying to get around the U.S. Constitution. And they clearly invoke interventions by, as your man said, a designer. And then, of course, he went on to quote what it was. It was the designer. It was the God of the beginning of St. John's Gospel.
In the beginning, there was
no
the Word.
Question, but, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question but that intelligent design is trying to introduce a form of, I call it creationism light, a form of religion into American biology schools.
Give us some historical perspective on this, if you would, Michael Roos. Many fundamentalist Christian believers, and perhaps others, find evolution itself and have from the beginning in the 19th century a challenge to their belief. It sort of rocks their belief system. It's not the first time that science did that. It happened with Copernicus when the centrality of the Earth in the cosmos was disproved. Are there parallels between how that was received over time, opposition to that over time, and this or not?
Well, I think there is, and certainly there's parallels, say, between the time when Darwin came along and you had somebody like Thomas Henry Huxley debating the Bishop of Oxford and throwing, charges at each other. I mean, again, I mean, I agree just 100% with Richard Dawkins on his science. I agree on his religion, too, but there's no question but that people like Richard Dawkins, I think, are presenting a very religion unfavorable perspective. I mean, Richard's the guy who, one of his books is, what is it, The Devil's Advocate.
Yes.
And it's quite clear that he thinks that as a Darwinian...
A Devil's Chaplain, I think that is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Hmm? I'm sorry to interrupt you. The Devil's Chaplain there where he quotes...
The Devil's Chaplain. Okay, mm-hmm. Even more so. All right. So what I think we've got is a classic debate. I mean, you don't have a fight unless both sides are fighting. I mean, if one side runs away, there's no fight. And it's pretty clear that what we've got are the intelligent design people, the sort of the smoother face of creationism on the one side, and a great many, I mean, obviously not all, I mean, Kenneth Miller's name has been mentioned, and mm-hmm. he's a Catholic, but a great many Darwinians who are not only pushing their science, but also pushing a religious agenda, I think, under the name of the science. And I think if we're going to do anything in America today, and dear God, I really think that we do need to, then I think we're going to have to find some way of breaking this logjam and moving forward.
How do you do that? Should scientists, evolutionists, debate intelligent designers, or should they, as we found very widely, just say, no way, I'm not getting into that, it only elevates the intelligent design crowd?
I think that's probably true, and I certainly don't think it's going to be by saying, okay, you intelligent design people, you've got a good point, we'll give you some ground in schools.
No one's asking that,
that's
but...
the way mm-hmm. you go.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what you do is, if I can use such a phrase, I think you take the Hillary Clinton strategy and say, look, there's an awful lot of people in the middle. Clearly, our message is not getting through, and part of the reason is... we're threatening a great many values that Americans hold sacred. And, I mean, obviously what's going on is there's an awfully large number of Americans who are deeply committed to the belief in God and yet at the same time want to deal with science. Mm. And I think what we've got to do is speak to these people and show that being a scientist does not necessarily imply being an atheist, that or being an arch-Darwinian, and I am an arch-Darwinian, does not necessarily imply that you think that their views are silly or wicked or other things that Richard has in fact said in the past.
Some conservatives are speaking up on this from the other side. Charles Krauthammer wrote in Time magazine last week that he said what we're witnessing now is a frontier violation by the forces of religion. He wrote, how many times do we have to rerun the Scopes monkey trial? There are gaps in science everywhere. Are we to fill them all with divinity? To teach faith as science is to undermine the very idea of science, which is the acquisition of new knowledge through hypothesis, experimentation, and evidence. Do you think that view will ultimately out in this political culture, in the United States, Michael Rose?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I'm a philosopher. I'm the worst sort of person to make predictions about anything. I can't tell you what's going to happen next week. But certainly, I think that this is what we've got to do. I mean, I think it's very encouraging, for instance, in the environmental movement, that now a number of evangelical Christians are starting to say, folks, we've got to start rethinking some of these things. We've got to start taking some of the things that scientists are saying about things like global warming a lot more seriously than we do. So I really don't see America frozen in a position once and for all. I think that scientists have got to make a lot more effort to listen to the concerns of middle-range Christians. At the same time, I think we've got to reach out to middle-range Christians and say to them, look, science isn't the threat that you think. I mean, the one thing I would endorse more than anything that Richard Dawkins said is education, education, education. I really do think that this has got to start in our schools.
And that's the beginning. I heard one 10-year-old say to another just a couple of weeks ago, evolution is a fairy tale. Watch out. Michael Roos, Florida State University, thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.